You're listening to the North Canton Chapel Podcast. Thank you for joining us today. The North Canton Chapel exists to make much of Jesus every day to everyone. It's our prayer that this podcast will equip you to do just that. We believe that there's nothing like the church united together in gospel community. We'd love if you'd stop in and say hello in person if you're in our neighborhood. Our gathering times are at 9 and 10:30 a.m. Thank you again for joining us today. Let's listen in.
So there's a lot happening in the Marshall family right now. Just think I'd just share some things with you. First off, Karsten, our middle son, he turned 17 yesterday. That feels weird. Like 17, that's strange. I remember being 17, I'm like, all right, I can go to an R movie. Hopefully that's not what he's thinking. Our daughter Hannah, yesterday she marched in the Hall of Fame parade. This is kind of like our birthright here in Northeast Ohio, right? Like, you get to go to the Hall of Fame parade. We almost got rained out. It was a little intense. A couple weeks from today, Joseph, our oldest, heads to college. Oh, man. And so I had a moment this last week. I had come home from a late night meeting here. I got home at like 7:30 or something like that and hadn't seen anybody all day. So I go upstairs and there's Joseph in his room and he's packing up his stuff. And so like I had this moment where I totally was like flooded and I went like, hey, no, stop this right now. You cannot do this. I am not ready for this. So we had this whole conversation and I'm like, no, mom and I want to help you with this. Really, I was going, I am not emotionally ready to see you putting all this stuff in bags. It's funny, the dominant metaphor in the New Testament for understanding church is family. You feel things when you're part of a family. Some things you didn't expect. You feel things. This is you're supposed to grieve and you're supposed to honor and you're supposed to weep and you're supposed to feel things as part of a family. So hard to do, isn't it? Well, that's kind of where we're going to be this morning. In 1 Timothy. We're continuing through 1 Timothy, and this morning we're going to try and take on a giant chunk of chapter 5, where Timothy is told what to do with a very specific group as part of his church family, widows. Widows. And when we think about the New Testament teaching of widows, is this just like helping old ladies cross the street in Jesus' name? Is that what we're trying to do here? Is widow care in the New Testament just like a religiously toned social thing that we... No, there's much more to it than that. And this is a beautiful, beautiful section of scripture. And we're going to get to it in just a second. But before we get to talking about widows, Paul's going to get in the deep weeds. But before he does, he has a few words that function like a banner over this whole chapter, and they are intensely family words. Here's what he says, 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 1. You can turn there, flip there, scroll there, or follow along on the screen behind me. He's going to talk about just general relationships. Here's what he says. He says, do not rebuke an older man. Remember, Timothy's young, probably in his 30s. But encourage him as you would a father. Younger men, treat them like brothers. He continues. Older women, mothers. Younger women as sisters in all purity. These two verses function like a banner over this entire chapter, I think. And we read that and we have this, maybe you have the same reaction that I do, that you go, oh, that's so cool. Look at church like mothers and sisters and fathers and brothers. Like, isn't that what we're about here? And so, yes, that's true. But I think our familiarity with that image of church as family keeps us from seeing how countercultural that idea actually is. And so, warning, deep water approaching, and then we're going to continue in the text. The dominant teaching in the first century about how you're supposed to relate to other people, it was not family. Here is a sample of the dominant teaching about human relationships across gender lines in the first century. This comes from a book that was written just a little bit before the time of Jesus. Just listen to how male-female relationships are characterized here, okay? This is not in the Bible. This is something outside the Bible, but it was read in churches. Listen. Do not surrender your dignity to any woman. Keep away from other men's wives or they will trap you. Don't keep company with female musicians, okay? they will trick you. When you see a good-looking woman, look the other way. Don't sit down to eat with another man's wife or join her for a drink. Why? You may give in to the temptation of her charms and be destroyed by your passion. That's the dominant teaching about how men and women should interact with each other at the time of Christ in the first century. Huh? And into that atmosphere, what do we get? Mothers and sisters, all purity. Here's what I want us to see before we even get any deeper into 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, those verses we just read. This is the redefinition and in some senses the return of gender roles God's way. Paul's saying, Timothy, make sure your church knows that women are neither objects to be used nor temptresses to be feared, but because of the transformative work of the gospel, they become mothers and sisters. And so we ascribe them that dignity. What a heading. The same thing goes for fathers and brothers. The first century was a competitive one. Let's not forget that this was the culture that gave birth to the Olympics. Competition is embedded, and so Paul takes the same tack. He says, no, those older guys are not just old guys that you put out to pastor, and those younger guys are not your competition. No. They are fathers, and they are brothers. What a beautiful vision for a church, right? So, with family as the banner heading, Paul now turns his attention to a very particular subgroup, and this is where we're going to spend the rest of our time this morning, in widows. Now, little couple statistics for you if you're a note taker. There are 1,633 words in 1 Timothy. 20% of them are devoted to widow care. That tells me two things. That widow care is something every church must do. If he's going to take up almost a fifth of his gospel or a fifth of his epistle to talk about this, that's a big deal. But it also tells me that this is something that takes a lot of thoughtfulness to do well. So here's where we're going. First, we're going to talk about why widow care is so important, okay? And you'll see this is much more than helping old ladies cross the street in Jesus' name. Much deeper. Why is this so important? Then, we're going to get right to Timothy. So who are we talking about here? You'll find that widows in the first century, as it's today, this is not a monolithic, homogenous group. So who are we talking about? And then lastly, I want to wrap up. We're going to talk about how do we actually do this? How do we care for widows in a way that is representative of the heart of the Lord? And then we're going to share in communion today, which I think is incredibly appropriate when we talk about church being family. So, few note takers. We're going to start with the why. Three reasons why you should care for widows. Why does this matter? It's much deeper than it's a nice thing to do. So I want to give you three reasons right up front before we even get to the text. First, caring for widows strengthens the church. Caring for widows strengthens the church. I want to take you to the first place that we see widows in the New Testament, and it's in Acts chapter 6. Let's read this. You can follow along. Acts chapter 6. Now, in these days, what days? The early days of the church. When the disciples were increasing in number, okay, so the church is growing, a complaint by the Hellenists, or that is the Greek members of the church, arose against the Hebrews, those of Jewish origin. Why? Because their widows were being neglected in the daily distribution. And so the 12 summoned a full number of disciples and said, it's not right that we should give up preaching and the word of God to serve tables. So therefore, brothers, pick out from among you 7 men of good repute, full of the Holy Spirit and wisdom, whom we will appoint to this duty. Now, here's what's going on. This is the early church. These are our spiritual great-great-grandparents, and the church is just taking their first steps. They're like a toddler at this point, and they're starting to stumble a little bit. Why? Because it says, some widows are being neglected. Now stop for a second. Of all the things that the early church had to worry about, Roman persecution, false teaching, and where did Jesus go again, and when is he coming back? They talk about this? This, why? Judaism had a very specific system for distributing food among the poor. And so for the Jewish believers in the early church, this was not a problem. But as the church started to grow beyond and expand beyond its ethnically Jewish base, the food baskets for the poor would not have been made available to people of different ethnicities, non-Jewish Christians. The problem gets serious. And so what did they do? Our spiritual ancestors fed people for the glory of Christ and the unity of his church. Get this. Widow care became part of the vehicle that God chose to bring ethnic diversity to the early church. Isn't that fascinating? They saw this as an opportunity to care for the vulnerable. And they said, okay, let's go. The principle, when God's people extend care, God blesses. So that's the first reason why this matters. Second reason why widow care is so important is caring for widows embodies God's heart. That's a strong statement. What do I mean? Psalm 68, verse 4 says this: sing to God, sing praises to his name. Lift up a song to him who rides through the deserts. His name is the Lord. Exalt before him. Well, what's he like? He's the father of the fatherless. Protector of widows is God in his holy habitation. And then Psalm 46, verse 9, almost the exact same image. The Lord watches over the sojourners. He upholds the widow and the fatherless. So this defender of the defenseless is part of God's identity. This is who he is. And then you look into the New Testament, this is carried on in Jesus, right? Because he raises a widow's son in Luke 7. He chastises those who rob widows in Matthew 23. There's something about the vulnerable that prick God's heart. But now, having said he's like that, God pushes further and he commands his people to follow suit, to embody his heart in our actions. Get this, in Deuteronomy 14, says this. Remember, this is an agrarian society. They're all farmers. Most of us are not. But here's what he says. At the end of every 3 years, you shall bring out all the tithe of your produce in the same year and lay it up within your towns. And the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance with you, and the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, who are within your towns, shall come and eat and be filled, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands and all that you do. Fascinating. Similarly, Deuteronomy 24:19, very similar command, says this: when you reap the harvest in your fields, and you forget a sheaf in the field, like you realize you left some produce out there, don't go back and get it. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. Well, what if we don't do that? What if we just kind of go, let them fend for themselves? Exodus 22, get this. You shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. Well, what if we do? If you mistreat them, and they cry out to me, this is God speaking, I will surely hear their cry. My wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives will become widows, and your children fatherless. Holy moly. Here's what I want us to see. There is a connection between how God's people care for the vulnerable and how God blesses them. It's a big deal. Third reason why caring for widows is important, and then we're going to get to the text. Caring for widows is a mark of true religion. James says this in James 1:27. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God is this, : to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained by the world. This is crazy to me. This is a great definition of practical Christianity. How do you know that you're saved? If your heart breaks for this, I think it's so fascinating to me that James offers these words in response to people who are asking that question. How do I know if my heart is being formed after God's heart? And so his statement is kind of hiding a question. Who do you care about? Do you only care about people who can benefit you, or do you care about people who can't? That's what God did for us. He cared for us when we could not benefit him. And so quick word here, let's not get the cart before the horse. He's not saying, if you do this, you will become saved. That would be salvation by works. He's saying, if you find that you do this, if you find that you care and your heart breaks, it's probably evidence that you are saved. Now, let's put all this together. Why does God take such an interest in widows? And here comes some pretty important theology. While this is not always the case, in most cultures and in many circumstances, orphans and widows are more vulnerable, more exposed to risk, and usually not in a position to repay kindness that is shown to them. Not always, just often. So follow me on this. When we as God's family show unreciprocated kindness and care, we actually image God's love for us. Here's the thinking. As needful as widows and orphans might be financially or provisionally, they are nowhere near as needful as we all are spiritually. Widow care and orphan care is how we learn and reveal God's love for us. We care for the vulnerable because that's who we are. Now, with all that under us first, let's get to 1 Timothy and the second question. That's why to care. Well, who are we talking about here, Timothy? Let's get specific. And in this huge section devoted to caring for widows, Paul gives Timothy three categories to think in. And at first, this like strikes me as really fastidious, like really splitting hairs. But I think it's actually kind of helpful. The first group he talks about are those that he calls truly widows, which is interesting. He says this in 1 Timothy 5, verse 3. Honor widows who are truly widows. Interesting word choice. What does he mean? What does he have in mind? Thankfully, he expands in verse 5. He says, he or she who is truly a widow, left all alone, has set her hope on God and continues in supplications, which by the way, means prayer. Kavi, if you're listening. And prayers day and night. Okay, so she doesn't have anybody around, but she seems really spiritual. And then Paul gets oddly specific in verse 9. He says this, let a widow be enrolled, which is interesting. It like gives an idea that like there must have been a list that Timothy had. Let her be enrolled, probably not a spreadsheet, but whatever, if that's your thing. If she's not less than 60 years age, having been the wife of one husband, having a reputation for good works, if she's brought up children, has shown hospitality, has washed the feet of the saints, cared for the afflicted, and has devoted herself to every good work. Eight stipulations. What do we do with all that? It seems like quite a filter before caring. I got to get through that. I got to make sure she's all those things before I can care for her. Now, just like every other list in 1 Timothy, elders, deacons, all this other stuff, this is not a checklist. This is a portrait. It is never God's intention that we overcomplicate compassion, okay? So Paul is not urging Timothy here to prop up a widow in front of the church and go, okay, yeah, okay. You did wash the feet of the saints, didn't you? Mm-hmm, okay. 59 and a half. Sorry. Come back next year. That's not what he's doing. This is not God's intention that we overcomplicate compassion. So what do we do with all this? Put it all together. This is Paul leveling the playing field, saying, let her be loved. Timothy, attend to this. Notice what's not on the table. It's not what she gave to the church, not how wealthy she was. It's not what her husband did or how much he gave to the church. It's not who her family is. This is really a portrait about one thing. Did she walk with Jesus and does she need support? If so, Timothy, care for her. That's the portrait of a true widow according to this section in 1 Timothy. How about this second group of widows? Who else are we talking about? He says, widows with family. Okay, this first group, they have nothing. He said, they've got no one around them. They're completely alone. They're truly widows. But he parses this a little bit differently in verse 4. He says, but if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn how to show godliness to their own household and make some return to their parents. Wow. For this is pleasing in the sight of God. I love this idea. Basically, repay your mom for the kindness she's shown to you over your life. Oh. And every mother silently said, mm-hmm. But we go, well, this is really hard. Like, I got kids now and we're busy with our stuff. What do we do about that, Paul? We're really busy. Verse 8, but if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for the members of his own household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. That's how seriously God takes this. If you can't love your mom or your grandma or your aunt or your mother-in-law, if you can't benevolently show and repay the kindness they've shown to you, dude, you're so far from the heart of the Lord. Then he imagines a slightly different scenario in verse 16. Slide down a little bit more. If any believing woman has relatives who are widows, okay, so this would be mother-in-law, aunt, someone on any side of the family tree who needs care, what? Let her care for them. Well, this just got a little bit tighter. Now we're talking about mothers-in-law. Mandy's mom cared for her mother-in-law right up until almost the time she passed. They cleared out a bedroom for her in their home, and she moved in. All Grandma Chisholm's stuff. She went with her mother-in-law to doctor's appointments when she couldn't drive. In the morning, she had that little medicine case with like the little flippy flap lids and made sure she got all her meds right every morning. Was that hard for her? I will let you ask Mandy's mom the next time they are in town. Yes. But that's what Paul's talking about here. Here's the point, especially with widows with family, because that's the second group of widows. That whole honor your father and mother thing, remember that? Way back in Exodus? That's not just for little kids to finish their broccoli before they get up from the dinner table, right? We like to leverage that. Well, it says honor your father and your mother, so finish your broccoli, clean your room, and do what I say. That command extends into adulthood to include things like if she's your mom or your grandma or your mother-in-law, if she's a widow, check in on her. Go to her doctor's appointments with her. Mow her grass if she needs that done for her. If she has to move in with you, that's part of the deal. Make sure she's cared for. We're going to get to this third group in a minute, but before I do, I'm going to say something that's a little politically incorrect, and you can email me later. As women age in our culture and in Timothy's culture, they often become more vulnerable. That's the politically incorrect part. So, more susceptible to scams, more vulnerable to be taken advantage of. That's just a thing. And I know that may not be a popular comment, but in my experience as a pastor, it's absolutely true. And what I want us to see here is that it is God's design that the vulnerable be protected. And Paul is telling Timothy that a widow's primary line of support ought to be her family, the kind of family that steps up, steps in to provide meaningful protection and care. And if she doesn't have that, the church becomes that. What a beautiful picture. Isn't that amazing? So countercultural. Basically, if your mom is a widow or your grandma's a widow and you want to please God in your relationship with her, show up. That's what he's saying. Those are the first two groups, okay? So you've got truly widows, widows with family, and then a third group, younger widows. And this is where things get conflictual. You ready? We're going to take this one in one chunk. Just buckle up. Here's what he says. Refuse to enroll younger widows. Hard line. Why? For when their passions draw them away from Christ, they desire to marry and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. What? Besides that, they learn to be idlers. Going about from house to house, not only idlers, but also gossips and busybodies saying what they should not. Oh my goodness. So I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander. Some have already strayed after Satan. Holy smokes, what is he talking about here? Marriage is better than Satanism. Is that what he means? Gosh, this is dark and spooky. What could he possibly mean here? Like, and I'll be honest, when I read that at first, it sounds really chauvinistic. It sounds really condescending, really unfair, really insensitive. And I go like, Paul, I mean, I guess that could describe some widows, but all of them, all young widows are this way. I read that, I'm like, this cannot come from the heart of the God that I know. This sounds so general. It sounds so alarmist. It sounds so condescending. And is Paul imagining marriage as like some restraint against sinful young women? Like, get married and you won't sin as much. And it almost sounds punitive. He says, don't enroll them. Why? Because they gossip. So don't give them food. Okay, three quick points of clarity, and then we're going to move off of this one. First, and I think this helps me, so I think it'll help you. We should see Paul's words here specifically. Okay? It's likely that Paul is addressing a very specific problem in Ephesus at that time. So he is observing something that's actually happening in Timothy's church. Here's the situation. There seems to be a group of young widows who, for whatever reason, have let go of Jesus and they're walking away from the faith. And so we should probably not see Paul's words here as prescriptive for what every church ought to do everywhere, but particularly and specifically what this church in Ephesus should do in this time. Okay, that's one thing I think that helps to make sense of what Paul's saying here. Second point of clarity, we should see Paul's words here culturally. In Timothy's day, marriage was less romantic and it was more economic. You didn't get married because you fell in love. You got married so you didn't starve. It's especially true if you're a minority group like Christians. So Paul's speaking to a scenario here where a young widow might be so overcome by fear for lack of provision that she may run off with a pagan husband rather than keeping her faith anchored in Christ. That's what he means in verse 12 when he warns that they would incur condemnation having abandoned their former faith. And so what he's saying is don't let your eagerness to be remarried, get food on the table, eclipse or outrun your commitment to Christ, which is a great practical word for anyone. Third point of clarity, I think we should see this pastorally. Pastorally. This is Paul talking to Pastor Timothy. Always remember that when you're reading in 1 Timothy. This is Paul inviting Timothy to play an active role in something that he may be pastorally blind to. Timothy, you know, if you know a young widow who wants to get remarried, that's awesome. That would be great. Your job, Timothy, introduce her to a believing husband, and if they want to have more kids, that's awesome. That'd be great. Get on with their life. The contentedness of a good marriage can ward off spiritual attack. Hence his comment at the end of verse 14 where he says, give the adversary no occasion. Now, does that mean that has to happen for all young widows everywhere? No, of course not. He's just saying that could be the pathway for some. And does Paul mean to exclude genuinely needy younger widows from care until they get married? No, of course that's not what he's saying. Paul's imagining a scenario where Timothy would step up and help younger widows who want to remarry rather than ignore them, thus leaving them to the world and figure it out on their own. So I think it's wise to see Paul's words here specifically, culturally, and pastorally. Now, with all that said, to young Timothy, eventually we got to come out of the clouds and go, okay, what do I do? Enough theory, enough principle, enough just general stuff. How do I do this? And right now, I know that in this room or watching online, there's two reactions. For those of you that are widows, you're very self-conscious because I've been talking about you for the last like 25 minutes. For those of you that are not widows, which is most of us, you might be going, okay, well, what do I do? Like, I'm motivated. I get it. It's God's heart. Like, how do I step up? What do I do? I hope you're feeling that. So what we don't want to do, we don't need to develop a widow care manual. Like, here are all the instructions for every widow everywhere. Do this and we'll be fine. What we also don't want to do is go, well, that's the deacon's job. We'll let them figure it out so I can get on with my stuff. So I think what's best is to lay out a few very practical principles for widow care. We said when we started that the church is like family. How does family care for each other? Now, some of these things I'm going to share with you. I'm going to give you nine of them quickly. Some of these are going to be just how to help people grieve. Others are going to be more specifically aimed at widows. I feel like the title of this list should probably just be abbreviated, just be a human, but we'll get to it. All right. Number one, how to care for widows well. Choose to see people, not types. In thinking about widows, we need to be really careful that we don't cast every widow as this dire, dour, dismal, hopeless person. Most widows I know don't want to be thought of as widows first. The loss of a spouse is not the primary marker and defining attribute of their personhood. It's a life-changing thing for sure, but widows are not a monolithic group. As a group, widows do share a very specific kind of pain. But as individuals, that pain always looks very different. And so as a church, we need to understand that. Just like if you're married here this morning, I wouldn't ask you to speak for all marriages. I don't think we should expect a widow to speak for what it feels like for all widows to be widowed. So let's just say, let's choose to see people, not types. Number two, don't shame sadness with the gospel. So this past week, in preparation for this message, I sat with one of my friends here who is a widow, and I just wanted to hear a little bit more of her story. And she told me this story that for her husband's funeral, not here at this church, this was many years ago, she was walking in down the center aisle behind the casket, okay? Like a little bit of a kind of a procession. You've been to those kind of things. And she's sobbing, which is normal. And then a couple days later, she got a letter from a friend and legitimately said, "Why are you crying? Don't you have the hope of the gospel? He's in heaven." And to the point of like doubting her salvation. And she goes, "I really wonder if you know the hope of the gospel." That happens more often than we would think. Now, we're gospel people here, and we love the gospel. We love that the gospel has changed us and gives us hope, right? So if you're the kind of person that has this like inner drive, this insatiable need to make a beeline for the gospel anytime you see pain, please understand that pain is normal, even for hopeful Christians. We've got to say that. Pain is not the opposite of hope. Most often, it is the pathway to hope. Jesus cried at a funeral, and if Jesus can do it and not sin, I think it's probably fine for us. Pain cannot be faithlessness leaking out of your eyes. Most often, it's faithfulness just bumping up against what it means to be human in a fallen world. So let's not shame people with the gospel. Sideline, this is another note for another day, but if the gospel that you're believing makes you less human, it's not the gospel. It's something else. All right, number three. Be curious enough to really listen. I saw something the other day that I thought was pretty intriguing. I wanted to read this to you. When you choose a spouse, you are choosing your eating companion for about 20,000 meals, your travel companion for about 100 vacations, your career cheerleader and your retirement friend, and someone about whose day you will have to ask 18,000 times. Some of you, it makes you rethink marriage. but imagine, for widows and for widowers, can you imagine what that would be like for that person to suddenly not be there? I think we need to be willing to hear stories about what it's like to feel the absence of the person that they've been with for all of those things. And too often, well-meaning, hopeful Christians try to minimize struggle through distraction. We say things like this. Hey, well, at least your kids are local. At least you got a great church around you that's helping you out. At least the house is paid for. At least you got some stuff set up. Author and speaker Brené Brown, who is a masterclass in empathy, said, "Very seldom does an empathetic response begin with the words, 'at least.'" And the impulse is natural because we don't like seeing someone that we love be sad. Here's the corrective word for most of us who have not walked that path. Distracting from sadness usually just puts off what needs to come. And so we need to resist the urge to save them from sadness and be really curious to listen. So speaking of curiosity, number four, principle number four, check your motive. Here's what I mean by this one. Grieving and grief in general makes most of us feel really uncomfortable. I don't like being around grieving people. Why? I don't like it. Often more than we recognize. And we instinctively know that truly empathizing with someone who is truly grieving means that I have got to connect with something in myself that resonates with some part of their story in a deep way. And that takes vulnerability and courage and risk. And so sometimes what we end up doing is expressing a form of care that tries to make their pain go away so I won't have to feel uncomfortable anymore. It's a super common thing. So instead, what do? Be genuinely curious about them. Widows are not, and anybody who's grieving, is not a puzzle for us to solve. They're just people for us to love. So ask yourself, before reaching out, ask yourself, why am I reaching out? Do I genuinely care for them, or is this about me? Spinning off of that, number five, don't have your plan for their grief. Common tale that I hear a lot, and sometimes this This is internal, and sometimes it's external. Something like this: well, I mean, it's been 2 years. Or, well, it's been 5 years. It's been 10 years, as if to imply, like, aren't you over this yet? Sometimes it actually comes the other way with people who are young and they lose a spouse and they get remarried and something says something, or somebody says something horrible, like, it's only been 6 months. How could you even think about getting remarried? Do you know how dishonoring that is? What's the source of that? A lot of that sometimes is, I don't think that I would be feeling that way, so I don't think you should be feeling that way. So a quick corrective word. Do not have a plan for what grief looks like for somebody else. Instead, commit to being present when grief chooses them in that moment. And you have to acknowledge that when grief chooses somebody, it's probably going to be at a time that's very inconvenient for me. But that's what love is. Grief does not follow my plan. They don't need my plan. What they need is presence. So, switching over to a couple more proactive ideas, I'm going to give you four more really quickly. Initiate care. Initiate care. There's this great movie that came out in the 90s called Dead Man Walking, where Susan Sarandon plays the part of a nun, which I've often thought is like hilarious and very odd. And she cares for this family who has just lost a child in a murder case. And she's a nun. And she reaches out to the dad. And she says to the dad, she says, if you need anything, just call me. I've said that to people. The dad looks right back at her and he says, sister, I want you to think how arrogant that sounds. That line of dialogue has always stuck with me. If you need anything, call me. I'll be over here. Just call me. When someone we love is in pain, expecting them to initiate contact can often feel very unkind. And so initiating contact on our side sounds like this. Hey, you've been on my mind. I'm just checking in with you. How is today going? It can be a text conversation just to say, like, hey, we're mulching our front yard. We've got a little extra mulch. Can we come over and help you out? It could be an invitation in church to be like, hey, you want to come sit with us this morning? We'd love to have you sit with us. Number seven, step into a need that considers who they are. I love that our church, we love to respond to needs. We are a generous church, we're a caring church. But let's pull this back to the text real quick. Unlike Timothy's culture, where widows are predictably more marginalized, widows in our world have a wider spectrum of needs. Okay, so in the first century, if you're a widow, you were pretty much done. Like, that's why he spends a fifth of his letter writing to widows. Not always true today. Some widows are very well provisioned for financially. It's great. Some widows are well provisioned relationally. So don't assume that every widow is destitute or she can't mulch her flower beds or that she has no family support. In Timothy's day, maybe, but not always true here. And so one of the best ways to step into a need that considers who they are is to learn who they are. Number eight. I just want to be quick. Consider your everyday rhythms and spaces. Here's what I mean. No one wants to feel like they're a project, especially widows. Like, we have never talked before. Why are you calling me now? That just like pushes it further. Or a lot of times, those of us who care, we work so hard to not screw it up, we end up screwing it up. And so I think a wise principle is to slow down long enough to see who's already in your life and how you might step closer to them. You're not responsible for all widows and orphans, but you are responsible for those that you know. So who's already in your life that you can extend practical care for? Number nine, and this will be the last one we'll hit, care enough to care imperfectly. No one knows how to care for another person perfectly unless you're Jesus, and you're not, so. This is just a sinner caring for another sinner. I need to be willing, and we need to be willing, to let people receive your imperfect care and actually extend grace. You don't have to try to put that pressure on yourself. Suffering people know that you don't know what to say. Silence, though, is usually worse. And so in my experience and my word to you, it's better to awkwardly stumble through something you sincerely mean than to try to say something perfect that you don't mean. I think the summary here is just be sincere and please be a human. So here's where I want to go. I think it is so great that our rhythms here at North Canton Chapel allow us to celebrate the Lord's Supper and communion when we do. And there's so many times, I don't know if you've had this experience, where like the word that we just happened to preach follows right into this idea of sitting around a shared table together. And so we're going to celebrate communion in just a few moments. But I want to draw this back to where we started. Widow care is not just helping nice old ladies cross the street. Widow care is about saying, you know what? There's somebody who needs care in my life, and I can be a visible representation of the love of God to them. And as we turn our thoughts toward communion, consider this. God cared for us at our most vulnerable, and he extended to us a gift of care that is remarkable. When we drink grape juice and bread, and we have it in just a few moments, this is not just some like empty thing. This is a memorial meal to cause our imaginations to rewind to a cross and say, gosh, how much must God love me to send his son to die for me when I was helpless to earn my way back to him? That's the goal of communion. This is mindfulness and attentiveness to the good, honest, pure love of God shown in the cross of Christ. So a couple instructions. Deacons, if you guys would come on forward, they'll begin passing. And once you get to where you gotta go ahead and start passing the trays. If you're a believer, this is for you. If you've trusted Christ, this is for you. And if you're not, or if you don't know that you are, just let the plate pass you by, that's okay. There's a double cup. There's bread on the bottom and juice on the top. And if you call North Canton Chapel home, you know this, but I'd invite you just to hold on to those for a few moments and remember that God cared for us when we were vulnerable and powerless. And that is our call as a church to live as family with each other in these days. So take a few moments just with the Lord, and then I'll come back up and we'll take the elements together.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the North Canton Chapel Podcast. If this ministry has blessed you in any way, please share this episode with your friends or spread the word on social media. If you subscribe and leave a 5-star review, it goes a long way to helping us make much of Jesus every day to everyone who hears these podcast episodes. You can also donate to this ministry at ncchapel.com/give. Thanks again for joining us. May you go out into your places and spaces, making much of Jesus every day to everyone.